Good morning. We are delighted to welcome several guests this morning. We have two high school groups. Would the River Valley High School students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we have the Durand High School students. Would they stand? And thank you all for coming. The students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. The court invites students from all over the state to come and listen to an oral argument, and if the students accept this invitation, they are sent briefs in the case we are about to hear, and the students may engage in activities related to the case. They then come to listen to an oral argument, and after this argument, they will meet with the justice of this court to discuss the procedures of the court in accepting and deciding cases, not the substantive issues involved in the case. Everyone is welcome to join the students and the justices after the hearing on this case. We also have with us some special guests from the United States and Milwaukee and Madison and from Israel. And I would like our guests to stand, and then I will introduce them all if I can. All right? Maybe I'll let you all introduce each other. So why don't we start with you?
I'm Paula Simon, Director of the Milwaukee Jewish Council for Community Relations.
All right. You're with the Partnership 2000 Israeli delegate. Welcome. We welcome the Milwaukeeans too, but he came from further away. All right. Yes.
Your Honor, my name is Liz Joyce, and I'm here as the Roundtour. I'm also a member of the Partnership.
And you're with the Office of the State Public Defender. Thank you. Now, are you, I'm sorry, I didn't get your, this. The acoustics are bad here. Give me your name again.
Kobe Hassin. Kobe is like Jacob.
Okay, Kobe Hassin, Partnership 2000 Israeli delegate. Thank you.
I'm Josh. My name is Yitzhak Cohen, and I'm from the District of Nazareth.
And where do you sit in Israel? Good having you, sir. Yes, and you and I have been communicating to set this up. So I'm glad to see you all. You're all welcome today, and thank you for coming and considering watching our proceedings. Unlike in many courts around the world, you are free to come and go and leave at your discretion. We don't take much personal offense. Thank you. You may be seated. Do they have summaries of the case we are about to hear? Yes. If anyone else would like a summary of the case we are about to hear, would you raise your hand and the marshal will give it to you? It's easier to understand a case if they're if you know something about the facts or law. Does anyone else want to be introduced who's in the courtroom? All right.
John Roberts.
Oh, yeah. The court wants to be introduced. Right. I'm Shirley Abrahamson. I am the Chief Justice. Seated to my left is Justice, not John Roberts.
It's worth a try.
Worth a try. Justice Patrick Crooks. Justice Crooks is the justice with whom you will meet after this session. And to his left is Justice Patience Rogensack, and on the far left is Justice Annette Ziegler. And now I'll start at the other end. On the far right is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. And to my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. With those introductions made, we have no time for the hearing today, but we're going to take time anyway. And I call 06AP2753CR State v. Hubbard. Arguing on behalf of the state of Wisconsin is David Becker, Assistant Attorney General. Mr. Becker, good to see you again.
Thank you. May it please the court, as the Chief Justice has just indicated, I'm Assistant Attorney General David Becker, and I appear here this morning on behalf of the state of Wisconsin. Before I begin, I have what I guess I would consider a housekeeping matter, although I'm concerned that the marshal has just left. I gave the marshal 7 copies of the Whalen decision for distribution to the court. As should, I think, be clear from reading our briefs, the Whalen decision is the centerpiece of this case. And I think it would be helpful if you had copies of it in front of you as I deliver my argument, because I'm going to be focusing much of that argument on the Whalen decision.
Mr. Zaleski, you have any objection, assuming it's a correct copy? Court probably, each of us probably has one copy. Well, we'll take a second. It's okay. We'll do that. Go ahead.
Okay. This is an appeal from Jonathan Hubbard's conviction of injury by intoxicated use of a vehicle. The issue on appeal is whether or not the trial court erred in its response to a question that the jury submitted to it during deliberations. The facts relevant to that issue are very simple and straightforward. One of the elements of the crime of which the defendant was convicted was that he was operating under the influence of an intoxicant, operating his vehicle under the influence of an intoxicant. The intoxicant, by the way, in this case was prescription medication. This is not the normal case involving alcohol, but the statutes treat prescription medication like alcohol and in terms of what we would properly call drunk driving. In describing that element of being under the influence of an intoxicant to the jury in its initial instructions at the close of the case, before the jury retired to deliberate, the trial court explained in words that essentially parroted the definition of under the influence of an intoxicant in Wisconsin Statute 939.22 sub 42, that under the influence meant that Hubbard's, quote, ability to operate a vehicle was materially impaired. And now those are the key words that this case is all about. Was materially impaired because of consumption of a prescription medication. During deliberations, after having gotten that instruction and some additional instructions on what it meant to be under the influence, that wasn't the sum total of the instructions, but that was the instruction, that was the initial instruction on under the influence that used the words materially impaired. During deliberations, the jury sent out to the judge a note, a written question, and it read as follows. Could the judge define materially impaired? Does this mean that he was impaired enough to have an effect on the outcome? If not, what? That prompted a rather extensive discussion between the court and counsel, and ultimately, at the conclusion of that discussion, the court decided to send the following answer to the jury. And he sent a printed note with the following words in response to the jury's question, and that note read, please give all words not otherwise defined in the jury instructions their ordinary meaning. Less than an hour later, and I think probably significantly less than an hour later because of all of the proceedings that occurred between the time the note was originally sent out and the jury ultimately reached its verdict, and or between that time and the time that the judge answered the question, and then ultimately the jury returned its verdict. I think it was probably less than an hour later the jury returned a guilty verdict.
Counsel, if I may just interject briefly,
sure.
Do you think it makes any difference at all that the Court of Appeals focused on the phrase materially impaired and the note that came out from the jury appears to have quotes around the word materially, not the phrase materially impaired?
No.
Okay.
That's my answer. Okay.
Do you want to expand on that?
I don't know. I don't know the
I don't think there's any relevance to that one word.
No. I mean, It obviously indicates that the jury was concerned with the word materially rather than impaired, but in terms of the Court of Appeals decision, I don't think it makes any difference. They treated the whole phrase and dealt with what that whole phrase meant as opposed to just the word materially. I don't know how the judge could have well, never mind that. I don't think so. I don't think it makes. I don't see how it makes any difference. I don't see how if they focus on materially, they would have come up with any other decision than they came up with, because they went to a decision, Wayland, that they thought defined materially impaired, and in defining materially impaired, it defined both materially and impaired, I guess. So I think the decision would be.
What do you think is the import of that question? What would they say? They asked about materially impaired, and then say that it would affect the outcome. That's the last part of that.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, I assume what that meant is. Well, I don't know that we know what that means. But does this mean the question was after could the judge define materially impaired? The question was, does this mean that he was impaired enough to have an effect on the outcome? I assume that that probably meant that some of them perhaps were thinking that it had to have an effect that actually produced unsafe driving. And maybe we're wondering whether it had to go so far as to have been the cause of the accident. And of course, we know under Wisconsin law that's not true. That if the judge had focused on that question, the appropriate answer would have been no. It doesn't have to have an effect on the outcome. A person can, in fact, be under the influence and still drive completely safely. In a completely safe manner. He does not have to manifest his being under the influence by any particular acts of unsafe driving. That Wisconsin case law is clear on.
So you have a problem that this question is not quite clear. Did they attempt to clarify what it meant?
No, but the jury was apparently satisfied with the answer that the judge gave, that apparently took care of it, because they didn't come back and say, sorry, Judge, you didn't answer the question, or give it. We don't understand what the common meaning is and how the common meaning relates to these other questions. So, no, there were no further proceedings. Like I say, it was a relatively short time later that the jury returned its verdict.
Your position is what the instruction the judge gave was good enough, right?
My position is that what the instruction the judge gave was good enough. The Court of Appeals didn't think so. The Court of Appeals went to the Wayland decision.
Oh. Go ahead.
They've been distributed, but I think the Chief Justice indicated you probably all have a copy. And what they did is they looked at the full paragraph on page 27 of the decision, and they looked to the final sentence of that paragraph, which reads as follows. Material impairment, in quotes, under 939.2242 stats, and that's that section that defines under the influence and contains the words materially impaired, exists when a person is incapable of driving safely or quote within a quote, is without proper control of all those faculties necessary to avoid danger to others, end quote within a quote, and end the quote. They said that that's the language that the judge should have used in responding to the question. Now, the issue this court is being called upon to decide, I guess, is who was right, the circuit court in telling the jury to give the words their ordinary meaning, or the Court of Appeals, which said that the jury should have been told what material impairment means in the language that I just read to you from that paragraph in the Wayland decision. Now, in addressing that issue of who was right, the trial court or the Court of Appeals, I intend in my argument today, this morning, to take a slightly different approach than I took in my brief. In my brief, I focused on whether the trial court was right in answering the question in the way it did. And I basically defended the trial court's answer by invoking Wisconsin Statute Section 990.01 sub 1, which generally provides that all words and phrases used in the statutes shall be construed according to common and approved usage. And I argued that the judge simply told the jury what the legislature has told all of us we should do when interpreting statutory words were to give them their common and approved usage. Now, there is an exception for technical words or phrases with a particular meaning, and I spent a long time in my brief arguing that there is no technical, that materially impaired are not technical words, and it's not a phrase that has a peculiar meaning in the law. In oral argument this morning, I think I want to change this, my argument's focus slightly. And that is, I don't want to focus on whether or not the trial court was correct in answering it, in answering the question the way it did, but rather or not whether or not the Court of Appeals was correct in telling us that it should have been answered by use of the Whalen language.
I was going to say to you, maybe the circuit court is not the best, but it's good enough to pass, not reversing. I mean, isn't the issue ultimately what do you do about this? Maybe the Court of Appeals makes a better definition.
Okay,
you don't agree with that.
And
that's what you're going to talk about.
Now you have, indicated why I want to focus on what the Court of Appeals did, because I don't think it was a better definition. I think theirs was completely wrong. I think you're right. I think the trial court's answer can be defended. I think there are other answers that could have been given. But the other answers that could have been given do not include the Whalen language that the Court of Appeals said should be given. That, in fact, is why I think this case is here, and why the state sought this court's review of the Court of Appeals decision. If it had simply been a question of whether the trial court properly told the jury to give the words their ordinary meaning, I don't know how concerned we would have been. I don't know would depend on how they crafted their decision, obviously. But what really causes the state concern is not so much that the Court of Appeals didn't like what the trial court did, although we think that what the trial court did was defensible, but that they went on to invoke the Whalen decision as providing a definition for materially impaired. If that decision is allowed to stand, it's the state's belief that we're going to see a significant change in what the state is required to prove in order to establish that one is under the influence of an intoxicant. So.
You have to prove now. What did you think you have to approve in this decision in Hubbard?
I want to know what the change is. Pardon me?
In other words, I'm trying at what is the change?
Well, I think to put the change into focus, we have to first of all answer the first question of what does materially impaired mean? What does the state have to prove? And then we can compare that with the language of Whalen that the Court of Appeals said should have been given. To determine what materially impaired does mean in Wisconsin, so that we can compare it with the Whalen language, I think there are two sources to which we can resort. One is other portions of the Whalen decision other than those on which the Court of Appeals relied, and the other is the current pattern instruction on the crime at issue and on other crimes that defines under the influence of an intoxicant. Insofar as other portions of the Whalen decision are concerned, if you have Whalen in front of you,
We all have it.
You all have it now. All
right.
I would say we should, we're working our way through that decision in order to see if we can't tease out of it what materially impaired requires. I would first of all direct the Court's attention to page 22 of the decision. There, the Court set out the instruction that was given in Whalen. And the critical language that I think we need to look at in that instruction is basically the second half or the second two-thirds of the first paragraph of that instruction as quoted there on page 22. And the language that I'm talking about is the language that starts with any abnormal mental or physical conditions and states, talking about what it means to be under the influence, and says it includes any abnormal mental or physical conditions which are the result of indulging in any degree in intoxicating liquors, including beer, which tends to deprive one of the clearness of intellect and self-control which one would otherwise possess. And as we are going to see when we reach the end of this decision, That language was specifically approved as a correct statement of what it means to be materially impaired. Working our way through the Whalen decision, if we turn to page 25, we find the court quoting the instruction that was given in the Fond du Lac versus Hernandez case. And there we find in that, the first paragraph of that instruction, again, the last two-thirds of that paragraph, basically, we find basically that same language, any abnormal mental, in talking about what under the influence means, they say any abnormal mental or physical condition which is the result of indulging in any degree of in any degree in intoxicating liquors, including beer, in which tends to deprive him, namely the person who's accused of being under the influence of an intoxicant, of that clearness of intellect and control of himself which would otherwise he would otherwise possess. At the top of page 26, the court says, in Hernandez, we implicitly affirmed the validity of that language. The court then went on page 26 and talked about the pattern jury instruction that in existence in 1981, or what they refer, what this court referred to as the 1981 version of the standard jury instruction, which the trial court had used to craft its instruction in Whalen, but which had been supplanted by a later instruction, which the trial court refused to give. And while that while the contents of that instruction are not set forth in the Whalen decision, I did set them forth at page 16 of my brief. I don't know that you necessarily have to turn there if you want to take my word for it. That pattern instruction basically contained the exact same words that were contained in the instruction given, virtually the same words were given in Whalen, and as we've already seen, those words were basically virtually the same as the words that were approved in Fond du Lac versus Hernandez. And what does this court say then about that language? At the conclusion of the last full paragraph on page 26, it says, the 1981 standard instruction on under the influence was and is entirely consistent with the criminal code definition of under the influence. The criminal code definition of under the influence is the definition from which those words materially impaired come. So the only conclusion that we can reach, I believe, is that this court was saying that that language provides a proper, adequate, and correct definition of under the influence. And just to close out our review of the, proper definition of under the influence, and in providing a proper definition of under the influence provides a proper definition of materially impaired, which is used in the definition of under the influence in the criminal code. Then closing out our review of the Whalen decision, we will go to the last page, which is page 28. And there's the full paragraph after head note 3 on that page. There, this court once again invokes that same language, which I think is the critical language here for determining what it means to be materially impaired and therefore under the influence of an intoxicant. It quotes that language, which we already saw when we looked earlier in the decision at the instruction given in Whalen. And it quotes there being under the influence means that you're under the influence when there's any abnormal mental or conditions, or mental or physical conditions, which tend to deprive one of the clearness of intellect and self-control which one would otherwise possess. And moving later in that paragraph, what does this court say about that language? About five lines, not sentences, but about five, six lines from the bottom, this court says, this instruction accurately describes the circumstances in which a jury can infer whether an operator's ability to operate a vehicle is, quote, materially impaired, unquote.
Mr. Becker, is your point in all of this that the Court of Appeals picked out the wrong language from Whalen?
Absolutely. If we're going to look for a definition, if they were going to look in Whalen for a definition of what it means to be materially impaired, this is the language that they should have looked to, not to that last sentence of that paragraph on page 27 of the decision.
My understanding is, in any case, you think that what the trial court did here was sufficient.
Yes, that. But like I say, our primary concern, however, is not to the state would consider the disastrous effect on Wisconsin law that would arise out of a decision that would affirm what the Court of Appeals said should have been given. And Go ahead, Justice Abramson.
Well, one of the problems is you're picking out language, and I find that it is consistent in the places you've selected. But there's language in here that's also very complementary to other standards, and it's not consistent. So you say a rather material impairment exists when a person is incapable of driving safely or is without proper control of the facilities necessary to avoid damage to others, citing two Wisconsin cases.
And that's the language that the Court of Appeals relied on, and that's right. And we don't think that reliance was appropriate because we think that
And then you have the same language at the bottom of 28, and then, I mean, I could probably go through and find the same language elsewhere. So why do you pick one set of words and not the other?
Because
But you have
if the court, I'll tell you why, because the two sets of language cannot coexist. They're inconsistent with one another. The language that talks about incapable of safely driving, which is the language on which the Court of Appeals relied in saying that that's what the jury should have been told, that sets a much higher standard than these portions of the instructions that you approved in Wayland sets. And maybe before I go and explain that further as to why I think it sets a much higher standard, I'd like to return to the progression of my argument, because I said I think we can look to two places to determine what materially impaired meant, and I said the first one is to look to the Wayland decision, other portions other than what the Court of Appeals relied on.
I want to ask and stay with the Wayland decision.
Okay.
As I look at the final paragraph of the Wayland decision, and you walked us through parts of it, the language of the opinion is consistent in some places and arguably inconsistent or varies, rather, in others. But then you get to what I call the ta-da, right, the very ending. And what do they say? So after all these pages of discussion, here it is, folks, the last sentence, the ta-da. And it says, what you started citing but didn't finish that sentence, they say, and I'm looking at the last few lines of the opinion, because operating a vehicle requires the use of mental and physical facilities, this instruction accurately describes the circumstances in which a jury can infer when an operator's ability to operate a vehicle is materially impaired or when a driver is incapable of safely driving. I see that as the ta-da. I see that as materially impaired, and a shorthand for materially impaired, or another way of saying it, the Court of Appeals, or rather the Court is saying here in Wayland, is just that language, is incapable of safely driving. Why am I wrong?
Except the thing, the problem is that the language that this Court approved that was found in those instructions that this Court approved, the instruction given in Wayland, the pattern instruction, the earlier 1981 pattern instruction, which was based on the Fond du Lac instruction. That language does not set the standard of incapable of safely driving. So
is this an example of imprecise drafting, though?
Well, I...
You wouldn't want to say that.
Well, I wouldn't want to say that without premising it with the words "with all due respect to the court."
Yeah, okay.
you could say it.
But I think with all due respect to the court, I might say that the Wayland decision is less than clear. But I think it, I mean, it's less than clear because of these little twists that somehow got thrown in there that I don't necessarily think follow, including that final language in that sentence that you just read and this sentence on which the Court of Appeals relied. I don't think that those are consistent with what this court said was the proper way to instruct on under the influence and therefore on the question of whether one is materially impaired, which is what decides whether one is under the influence.
Your bottom line was that if you accept the Court of Appeals language, then the state's proof is different. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yes. And I don't know whether the proof is different, but the level of proof is clearly different. Okay. It seems to me that the language that the Court of Appeals, that doesn't seem to me, I think it's absolutely clear that the language that the Court of Appeals called from Whelan sets a significantly higher threshold for finding one under the influence than is set by those instructions that we have just reviewed and that this court approved in Whelan, and that is set by the current pattern instruction on under the influence, which is slightly different, but which, like these other instructions, I think basically sends this message as to when material impairment exists. And it doesn't use this language, but if you wanted me to distill for you what I think all of these instructions say with regard to when material impairment exists, I would say, in words that I think are very close to words that I used in my reply brief in describing it, I would say, and let me just read what I've wrote in my notes here for the oral argument, material impairment exists when, as a result of consumption of an intoxicant, in this case a prescription medication, a person is less able to control his vehicle than he would have been able to had he not consumed the intoxicant. I think that's not the words that are used either in these instructions or in the current pattern instruction, which is slightly different, but I think it's the standard that all of those instructions set. And so what we need to do then is compare what I think is the standard set by those instructions, as I've just recited it.
Well, how does that comport?
Pardon me.
How does that comport with Section 939.22, paragraph 42?
Well, it comports, but because it's giving substance to what the words material impairment or materially impaired in that definition mean. That's what this case is all about. Is what do those words materially impaired in that definition mean? There is no further delineation of what those words mean in the definitions provided by the criminal code. So we have to give some substance to those words, and I suggest that the substance that we have to give to those words, consistent with the instructions this court has approved, consistent with the current pattern jury instruction, to which I haven't directed you, but basically says the same thing, is that material impairment exists when you're less able to control your vehicle than you would have been if you hadn't have consumed the intoxicant. That's the standard that is being set. Now, what is the standard that is set by the language on which the Court of Appeals relied? The standard that is set by that standard is that you have to be incapable. That's not the standard. The standard is you have to be less capable. That doesn't mean you have to be incapable. There's a difference between being less capable, in other words, that it has some effect on your ability, and incapable, which means that it has had an effect that renders you totally incapable, completely incapable of operating a vehicle safely. And I think, and I know that the district attorney in this case was very concerned when it was suggested that this Whelan language be given, because he felt, and I think absolutely correctly, that this set a much higher standard than the present jury instruction, the jury instructions already approved by this court, and the present jury instructions, which basically, in different words, basically say the same thing, and all of which simply indicate that you have to be less capable than you would have been if you hadn't been drinking, but not that it has to go to the extent of having rendered you incapable. And I find support for my contention that it sets to a high standard in that very same paragraph from Whelan that the Court of Appeals, from which the Court of Appeals called the language that it thought created a definition of material impairment. In that paragraph,
this is going to be your last comment with your red letter. But just give us the page and paragraph you're talking about.
All I'm saying is that in that paragraph you rejected substantial impairment as being too high a standard.
Right.
If substantial impairment is too high a standard, complete impairment, which is what incapable connotes, it's got to be too high a standard. It's even higher than the standard you rejected in that paragraph in Whelan, and thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Becker. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Stephen Zaleski, representing the defendant, Jonathan Hubbard. Mr. Zaleski.
Judge, may it please the court. Stephen Zaleski, I do represent Mr. Hubbard, the defendant appellant. I would like to begin, Judge, by addressing the basic issue of whether the words materially impaired have a common and ordinary meaning, as the state suggests, or as I believe and as the Court of Appeals indicated, they have a peculiar meaning under the law. And I believe the basic answer is that even though certain words may have a common and ordinary meaning under some circumstances, they can also have a very specific technical meaning under the law. And that specific technical meaning can be defined or established both by statutory law and by common law. I think we have numerous examples of statutes which basically render a legal definition for terms which most people would commonly recognize and understand. I cite a number of those in my brief. I would venture to guess most everyone would have an understanding of what the words vehicle, what the words human being, and what the words sexual intercourse mean. But it's interesting that the criminal code specifically defines those words. I would also note, Judge, that Chapter 990 operates in a similar function. It defines the United States, even though most people would know what the United States, what that term means. In addition to statutes, we have the common law, which operates in a very similar function. It serves to define words that may not be defined by statute, or if they are defined by statute, it serves to clarify such words. One example I give in my brief is the term operate, which is defined by statute G46.63B. The case law is still evolving to clarify what that term means. And I cite that case in my brief.
Counsel, so you would have the state prove that the driver is incapable of safely driving?
Well, Judge, I believe the basic element is under the influence. I do not believe that the term materially impaired per se is an element.
Right. It defines that element or that portion or that phrase used in the third element of the offense. But traditionally, materially impaired has not required that standard. It's required that the person consumed a sufficient amount so that they were less able to exercise clear judgment and the steady hand necessary to handle and control a motor vehicle. It's not required that impaired ability be demonstrated by particular acts of unsafe driving. And what would be required is that the person's ability to safely control the vehicle be materially impaired. But that does those definitions that have traditionally been given and approved would change if the definition is incapable of safely driving. So I just need to know how I put those two thoughts together with the existing instructions and case law.
Judge, I think you absolutely have to have a definition for materially impaired. If you take the state's position is basically materially impaired would be defined by if you're less able to operate a vehicle safely because you've consumed the alcohol or because you've ingested this drug. The problem with that, Judge, is this. I think with all these young people in the courtroom, I'm sure their parents have told them, if you consume any alcohol, you're going to be affected. With any alcohol in your body, you're going to go from a standard of 100% capability to something below than that. You're going to lose a certain degree of cognitive function. You're going to lose a certain degree of motor function.
But we aren't in a state where it's absolute sobriety all the time, except for probably these young people sitting in the courtroom.
Right.
That's different.
They can't drink at all. Nothing.
But we aren't in a state where you can't consume any alcohol and drive. We're in a state that has a limit. And so the jury then has to wrestle with what's above and what isn't above the limit. With a drug case, of course, that's different. And that's why we're dealing with this issue here, where traditionally in a OWI case, it probably doesn't arise as much.
Well, Judge, the standard that's urged by the state would be a standard that puts in place a standard just by virtue of consuming alcohol, you'd be less capable of safely operating a vehicle. There'd be no threshold put into place, no degree at which you become incapable of operating a vehicle are less capable or where you lose the proper faculties of being able to avoid a danger to others. Just by virtue of having some alcohol, you're less capable than if you didn't have any alcohol.
This is a prescription medication case, which I think is slightly different than an alcohol case. So I think we should try to stick to the facts of this case, even though it might, depending on what the court decides here, spill over into traditional OWI or alcohol-related cases. But there is basically an absolute sobriety provision with prescription medication, right? There isn't a limit. Like if you have 0.08 of Xanax in your body, then you're above the legal limit. It has to be that it materially impairs your ability, right?
Well, that's correct. It has to materially impair your ability. There has to be some degree. It has to be some threshold. And that's why I think the definition needs to be given for materially impaired, so that threshold or that limit is specifically defined. Otherwise, there is no limit. And the state is suggesting that anything less than what you would have been had you not consumed that is materially impaired.
Mr. Zaleski, let me focus in on the argument here, because as I hear the parties, there's two different things going on here, and I want to get back to the reason we took the case. My understanding is that on the one hand, your position is that, look, the jury asked a question here. They asked for a definition of materially impaired and what that meant. And the court said, apply your own common sense. Use the natural meaning of the terms to answer that question for yourselves. And I understand that that's the issue that you brought the case up here on, that the court should have given a definition. The sub-issue that I hear going on, the secondary issue that has been addressed at oral argument, is what should that definition be? And you've argued for the Whalen definition, and the state is arguing for a different definition, and you disagree with the state's definition. But the first question that has to be answered is whether there was error here in the circuit court not giving the definition to the jury when requested, or giving a definition to the jury when requested. And the reason I bring it back to that is it seems to me, in looking at the history of the jury instructions and how the committee has approached this and how the courts have approached this, including in Whalen, and going back to, what is it, Devine versus Bishel, or whatever the case is, that there seems to be disagreement among the professionals as to what the definition, in fact, is for under the influence. And the committee has difficulty coming up with a definition. So I want to focus first on the error that you alleged to get here and what the circuit court should or should not have done when the jury requested that question.
Judge, I think the error was in specifically answering the jury's question in the way that it did. We had a Supreme Court opinion which precisely answered the jury's question, and rather than directing the jury's view and deliberation in that direction, the trial court directed the jury's attention into something outside the realm of the law. The jury's focus was directed by the trial court into the realm of the common and ordinary. And that's where the error was, because we don't know what the common and ordinary would be for a particular juror or a particular jury. The danger is that a juror or jury could define that term materially impaired in a way that the law does not define it, in a way that we do not want that term to be defined.
So if I understand your position, I just want to make sure I've got it clearly, is that where you and the state may disagree as to what the definition of materially impaired is, regardless of what the definition is, the court erred in this case by not giving the jury a definition.
That's correct.
That's your point?
That is correct, Judge, in not giving that definition and also in misdirecting the jury, directing the jury to apply common and ordinary mean, is what that did. That directed the jury's attention away from a standard jury instruction. We can argue about which instruction would be more proper, the 1981 instruction that was approved in Whalen, or an instruction that would include the criminal code language. But irrespective of that, the error is that the jury in this case was asked to deliberate and infer based on common and ordinary meaning as opposed to standard approved language, established law. And that is where the error came in. The Court of Appeals correctly noted that when the jury is confused, if there's an issue as to not understanding the law, there's a risk that an improper factor is going to be introduced into the deliberation, and that happened in this case.
How do you respond to the fact that the current jury instructions that were modified in 2006, as I understand them, don't even use the word materially?
Well, Judge, the jury instruction in this case did use the term materially.
Well, I know they did in this case, but what I'm getting at is there seems to be a disagreement about what the instruction should say. And you're arguing for the specific language in Whalen. The state is arguing for something less than that. And we've got the initial threshold question of should the jury have been given an instruction at all in response to their questions. So it appears that there's extensive disagreement out there about what this term actually means. And so I guess the question for you and the question for Mr. Becker on rebuttal is, well, if the professionals don't agree on what it means, can we count on the jury to figure it out?
Judge, that's exactly correct, and that's why we need to have a specific definition, because the lawyers are going to disagree, courts are going to disagree, the legislature has disagreed, the jury committee was in a state of flux about it. We need to have a specific definition that answers this question, because it is going to come up time and time again. And if we defer to the state's position, we will not have a specific definition for materially impaired. It will remain undefined, and it will be left to the jury to infer what that means based on their own understanding of what common and ordinary may mean.
Counsel, I want to ask you, I want to take the second issue we have before us, and that is if there's an instruction which should, what it should be. But I want to try that through the back door and focus on what's an ordinary understanding of the word materially impaired. And I'm going to also ask, if time permits, your opposing counsel this question. And I'm going to assume that you have an ordinary understanding. Okay. Scale of impairment from 1% to 100% impaired. What do you think is the ordinary understanding of material impairment? How impaired is material impairment?
Judge, that is a very difficult question for anyone to answer, and I think therein lies the problem. My way of defining that would be to take a lesson from what Whalen did and define.
So your way of defining it, if you go into Whalen, sounds like 100% incapable. Is the Whalen definition? Plug the Whalen definition into my 1% impaired to 100% impaired. Where does Whalen fall?
Judge, I think Whalen does not require total impairment. It does not require complete incapability. It just requires, it speaks in terms of incapable of driving safely. It does not speak in terms of total incapability. And Judge, I think it's also important to note that exact language is used in the statute itself under the Motor Vehicle Code. The statute uses the exact same language as the language used in Whalen. I'm referring to 346.63. That section specifically prohibits operation of a motor vehicle while under the influence of an intoxicant to a degree which renders him or her incapable of driving safely.
And I appreciate the emphasis that you put on the words of incapable of what? Of driving safely, the emphasis on those words. But that merely changes the focus of the question. So so where does Whalen fall in the scale of 1% impairment to 100% impairment with regard to driving safely or safely driving?
Well, Judge, in terms of giving a quantitative answer, that's very difficult to do. I would say that it does not require 100% capability. It does not require anything close to that. If you can operate your motor vehicle and you can do that in a safe manner, then you're within the law.
Somewhat safely?
Well, it focuses on a degree based on a function. If you can carry out the basic functions of operating a motor vehicle in a safe manner, that's the inquiry. It's not total impairment, total incapability. It's a very fact-specific inquiry that really needs some contouring and shaping in order to answer that question. And I think just by virtue of the fact that people who have done a lot of research and have studied the area and have dealt with this case, it's still difficult to answer that question. And that's why we need a very specific definition to provide a jury to use as a yardstick to measure the evidence, because if we don't, they're going to grapple with this exact same issue.
Well, I thought the studies show that even one drink slows down reaction time. It might be only a couple of seconds slower to brake, a couple of seconds slower to see the issue, a couple of seconds. I'm making up a couple of seconds, but just a small, very small amount of an intoxicant can change your reaction time. Now, whether that amounts to whether you're incapable to a degree of driving safely or not is another issue, but isn't that the jury deciding whether or not you have some sufficient impairment so that it's not safe?
Judge, that is correct. I think that
we can tell them by degrees.
Can you tell them by degrees?
Yeah. If you think it's less than 10%, don't worry about it. 10 to 40%, it's within your discretion.
Judge, I
40%,
don't.
100%, you should find.
I don't think that you can do that, Judge. I think the reality is that if you do have a substance in your system, like the court indicated, you are going to be impaired in a certain respect. The question is, at what point are you materially impaired?
Okay. There were jury instructions here, right?
Yes.
1262?
Correct.
Pardon me?
That's correct, Judge.
That's the one that was given. And it says, under the influence of an intoxicant, means that the defendant's ability to operate a vehicle was materially impaired because of consumption of an alcoholic beverage, right? But it didn't stop there. Not every person who consumed alcoholic beverages under the influence, that term is used. What must be established is that the person has consumed a sufficient amount of alcohol to cause the person to be less able to exercise the clear judgment and steady hand necessary to handle and control a motor vehicle. Do you object to that instruction?
No, I don't.
You didn't. The trial counsel did not object. Did the state object to that?
No.
Okay.
Was modified at all by the court?
I'm sorry, Judge, I didn't.
When the instructions were initially given, was what the Chief Justice read modified?
Or was that the exact instruction? I'm reading right from the pattern instruction.
Judge, I believe that was the exact instruction. There weren't objections by other party, I believe.
And that was the exact instruction? Okay. Then, so it talks about less able, which is what, as I understood Mr. Becker's argument, that's what he wants, less able. So they got instructions, less able.
Then it says, it is not required that impaired ability to operate be demonstrated by particular acts of unsafe driving. What is required is that the person's ability to safely control the vehicle be materially impaired. No one objected to that. 1262.
Correct.
Counsel, when the chief is done, I have a question to follow up on.
Well, my point is, assuming that those were the exact instructions given, my point is no one objected to those instructions. The problem came when the jury asked a question, at which point a lot of judges would have said, I have given you the instructions, reread what I just read, right? There are other possibilities that could have been said. So this case comes here because check your own definition is what you're objecting to. And so did the Court of Appeals object to that, saying that mucked it up. And that as a result of that, there wasn't a full and fair hearing on the controversy, sent it back. That's what you want.
That's correct, Judge. And I believe the Court of Appeals astutely recognized and made the observation that perhaps it would have been better for the trial court to simply have reread the instruction, because at that point, the jury's deliberation will be still focused in on an established instruction, established law. But the problem was, in answering the jury's question, the trial court misdirected the jury. Once the trial court directed the jury to look at ordinary and common meaning, that injected an improper element into the deliberation.
I'm going back to really Justice Butler's analysis here. For your client today, that the Court of Appeals said that the use your common sense or common law, dictionary definition, you felt you believe that was error, that it was prejudicial error, you get a new trial. That's one part of the case. Second part of the case for us, which may not be immediately important to your client, is what, if anything, should be done to clarify these instructions as to what's materially impaired? So my question for you on the second part is, as a matter of law, do you think the Court of Appeals was correct?
Judge, I do. I do believe they were correct. I believe they were well-founded in what they indicated. I believe that language, Judge, comes from a 1931 decision. That language has been cited essentially in the Thomasick versus Lanterman case, which states one intoxicated is without proper control of all those faculties, the exercise of which is necessary to avoid danger to others while driving a car upon a public highway. So if we take the state's position, not only do we need to reject the reliance that the Whalen Court has placed upon authority that's been in place for quite a long time, we also have to turn our back on the fact that the statute, 346, uses the exact same language.
Counsel, the only difference between the one I read and the one actually given is that they substituted prescription medication, that the name of the prescription medication that was at issue here. But otherwise, as I have compared them, it is exactly the same. But I may be subject to wrong. I think Justice
Eager has a question.
Roberts.
You all.
Okay. All right. I need to ask both Mr. Becker and you this question. I started thinking about when I started going down the track of alcohol versus drugs, the jury instructions on an alcohol case versus a drug case, and the instructions are different. The alcohol case has the kind of language that was given here. In 2666, when you're dealing with a drug case, the element, the second element, instead of the one that is given for alcohol, which is under the influence of an intoxicant at the time of the operation of the vehicle, and then going down the how that relates to alcohol and clear judgment, steady hand, et cetera. In 2666, the criminal offense for operating under the influence of a drug, the second element requires that the defendant operated a motor vehicle while under the influence of, and then you, as a judge, you put the drug name in, to a degree which rendered him incapable of safely driving. That's the standard drug instruction. Why is it that the alcohol element or instruction was given instead of the second element that relates to operating under the influence of a drug? And did anyone ask the judge to give this element instead of the OWI traditional alcohol element? That to me is a significant issue because it seems we're all going down one path here, redefining OWI law as potentially as to how it relates in an alcohol case, but the relation in a drug case traditionally has been different. And I started down there when I started thinking about when I've tried drug cases versus alcohol cases and the kinds of instructions and issues that a jury deals with. So I don't know if you've thought of that or addressed that, or maybe I'm missing something, but I'm going to need you both to help clarify why 1262 with the traditional alcohol kind of element was given in a drug case, unless this was alcohol also.
Judge, I can answer that question in this fashion. 1262 is the standard instruction for causing injury by OWI.
Intoxication.
That's 940.251A. Is that what the charge was?
That's correct. In 1262 is the standard instruction on that. No objections were made. The court is referencing other instructions. 2666, I believe, those fall within the family of the Motor Vehicle Code. 2665 is the Motor Vehicle Code instruction for OWI with injury. So my basic response, Judge, is that the court and the parties did not object to using the standard instruction, which should have been used in this particular case.
Well, if I could follow up, Justice Ziegler's question, and this is, I think, very important under the circumstances of this case, the law is different between OWI alcohol and OWI drugs. If you look at Section 34663, Sub 1A. And this may go to Mr. Becker's position in terms of what generally he thinks the law should be for under the influence. It's anyone who operates under the influence of an intoxicant can be guilty of the offense. Whereas if it's a drug violation, it's under the influence of any drug to a degree which renders him or her incapable of safely driving. There's an additional element that's written right in the statute. So it would seem to me that the argument that the two of you have about what the instruction should have been is pertinent in an alcohol case, but it is totally irrelevant in this case where the statute requires incapable of driving safely. And I'm not sure that that's really been made clear up to this point.
Well, I would agree with the court. That's absolutely correct. The statute does require that. And my point is that the state essentially wishes to do away with that particular language, and I don't believe it can in light of the fact that the legislature itself has used that language in the statute for this particular offense.
Well, the argument has been about Whalen, as I understand it, and Whalen was an alcohol case. So to the degree that Mr. Becker may have a point, and he's arguing Whalen, it may involve that type of a decision. But this case, as I understand it, is a drug case, and the elements are different. And if the elements are different, I don't know I'd like to hear from Mr. Becker when he stands on this, but I'm not sure that the argument here with respect to the Whalen decision is really pertinent to the case that was litigated below.
What section of the statute are you looking to for the elements?
340.663 sub 1A. And if you look at section 2600 of the jury instructions criminal, it actually goes through the analysis and it talks about the differences between the two. And there's a difference between drug cases and alcohol cases. And that's one of the reasons why the jury instructions committee has had so much difficulty in trying to draw up a definition here.
What was he charged with?
Judge, he was charged with OWI with injury and
940.25.
That's correct, Judge.
1A.
Injury by intoxicated use of a motor vehicle.
Correct.
And according to the footnote, which may or may not be correct, to Wisconsin Jury Instruction Criminal 1262, it says the instruction is drafted for cases involving the influence of an intoxicant, which is defined, intoxicant is defined as alcohol or controlled substance or any other drug or an alcohol beverage or any other drug. Now, I don't know whether that drug means controlled substance. C-939-22, subsection 42. And then it says, for a model tailored to the influence of controlled substance, look at 2664. For a model tailored to the combined influence of an intoxicant and controlled substance. We're not dealing with a controlled substance. We're not dealing with alcohol here. So the question seems to be whether 2666 is the appropriate instruction. None of that was in this case.
Judge, none of that was in...
You should argue you get a new trial, period. Right, wrong instructions were given. Period. I mean, if that's the argument, I don't know if it's going to hold up, but that's what the bench seems to be saying.
Judge, Judge, that objection was not made at the trial court level, so it hasn't been made at this point, but I do understand the court in that regard. I agree.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Becker, you want to clarify the issue before us?
Well, I will try. You have opened a can of worms. I will agree.
A can of worms that affects this case, I don't believe. And let me say this. You want to go into 946.63.1A and somehow pull out that language of rendering incapable of safely driving and apply it here. And I'll tell you two reasons why it doesn't apply. The most critical one is because that language is describing the offense of drunk driving back in the Motor Vehicle Code. We are dealing, as Justice Abrams has pointed out numerous times, with a prosecution under the Criminal Code, under 940.25.1A or whatever the subsection is. And there, the definition of under the influence is controlled by
42, subsection.
And
42.
That does not contain any of that language, and that definition, as the footnote that Justice Abramson was reading from 1262, indicates that definition includes the gamut. That's number one. Number two is, I believe Justice Abramson is wrong in saying that this case does not involve a controlled substance.
Okay.
Because Xanax is the right plugged into the jury instruction was Xanax. In fact,
okay.
You pointed that
that's
out.
Right.
That's the only difference
that's
between
right.
the pattern instruction.
So that's a controlled substance.
And that's a controlled substance if
You've
what...
You've been treating it as a
drug.
Prescribed.
We've been talking loosely about it. Being, and it's a drug, too. I mean, it's a controlled substance. And therefore, even if you went to 940.631A... And this is really where the can of worms is, and it's a can of worms that I don't think you have to... deal with.
You don't want us to eat that, right?
But you have to decide what the words which renders them incapable of safely driving modify, and I suggest in that regard because, first of all, I'm going to talk too fast to make any sense, and second of all, my red light's going to be on before I probably finish. I direct you to go to 2600, which Justice Butler pointed out, the jury instructions committee a discussion of various problems in the drunk driving area, and go to page Starting at the bottom of page 20, there's a section dealing with incapable of safely driving, and it deals with this problem of what the words renders him or her incapable of safely driving modify, and they conclude that it does not modify the first under the influence phrase in that section, which includes intoxicant, controlled substance analog, or any combination of an intoxicant, controlled substance analog, comma, and then goes on to give other alternatives. And it's only with respect to those other alternatives that that incapable of safely driving applies, not with respect to that first alternative. And so coming back to the point I made with Justice Abramson, we've got a controlled substance here. We fall under that first alternative. So even if this were a pure, simple drunk driving case, which it is not, we would not have to struggle with this incapable of safely driving language and would not have to instruct the jury on that when we're dealing with a controlled substance as the
Let me see if I can summarize this in one sense. What I hear you saying is we should not flip from the charge defense, which was 940.25, if I keep my numbers straight, and look to 346.63, because that is not charged here.
That's right. That's my first point. Just has no application. If it had application, my second point was the backup argument. If it had application, if this were not a injury case that fell under the criminal code, but fell under the motor vehicle code, it was a simple drunk driving case, we still wouldn't have to worry about the incapable of safety driving language because we were at a controlled substance, and that language doesn't apply to controlled substance.
So you're saying don't wander off.
Don't wander off into that morass.
State in this, and 940 covers it by its very words. So we're under the...
The definition that controls the 940, which is in 939, yes.
Okay. Follow-up question. Should these statutes... 346.63 and 940.25 and whatever others are out there, should they all be interpreted the same so that you have the same level of whatever it is?
Well, I think that's what Wayland tells us, and I don't see any problem with that. I think that's what Wayland says, that because the Court of Appeals in Wayland had said they're different. And I think I don't know that I can point to a specific sentence in Wayland where you said the Court of Appeals was wrong in saying they're different, but that's the whole thrust of the Wayland decision, and there's language in the Wayland decision that...
Even though the statutory language is a little different in all of these.
The real question in Wayland, though, is whether the definition in the criminal code should be used for the 346 offenses.
Mr.
But, if you're going to get into this incapable of safely driving language in 346, that opens up a whole different can of worms, and I don't want to go there. I can't go. Well, my red light's on. I can't go there.
Mr. Becker, is prescription medication and controlled substance, are those the same thing?
Well, I don't know. No, I don't think they are the same thing, but what the jury was instructed on was Xanax. That they were claiming he was under the influence of Xanax, and that's a controlled substance. Or whatever it is, the generic name, and either Xanax and that or that generic or the both of them are listed as controlled substance.
Alprazolam.
Yeah, one of the two, and probably both. I looked this up 2 days ago, and I don't remember whether I found Xanax there or found the generic name, but they're interchangeable, obviously.
Do you have prescriptions for these?
And we don't want to get into that necessarily either. The facts were real confusing.
The instruction was because consumption.
He had a bottle with a
prescription medication. Yeah. So now, would you answer Justice Brasser's question?
And that question was again?
Prescription
medication and controlled substances are not the same. Well, you know what? I'm not an expert on controlled substances. Do you need a prescription for all there have got to be prescription medications that aren't controlled substances. Sure. That's got to be clear. When I get hay fever medication prescribed, those aren't controled substances. Yeah, so. Yeah.
Maybe I'm a little confused here. I thought I understood you to say that controlled substances, controlled substance was different from drug.
It's different from drug in
in the statute that I don't want you guys to go to because it just doesn't have any application here, and that's in 346.63.1a. There's a difference in terms, at least under the statute, there's a difference in terms of how a controlled substance is treated and how a drug is treated. But that difference is not to be found in the criminal code and in the criminal code definition of under the influence. In the criminal code definition of under the influence, they're all treated the same. Alcohol, controlled substance, drug, they're all the same. They're all various ways that you can be under the influence.
Prescription drugs seems to be covered under 939.2242.
No question. Yeah, no question about that. Like I say, it covers them all.
Right. And that defines intoxicant, right?
Intoxicant, exactly, and then lists the intoxicants that can cause that cause you to be under the influence.
So it
talks about alcohol, controlled substance, combination of alcohol, controlled substance, or of any other drug, or of any alcohol beverage and any other drug. So it covers
anything that could affect your
anything that leads to be classified as alcohol, and controlled substance, or a drug, and certainly a prescription drug is a drug. There's no question about that.
Perhaps I am drawing an incorrect inference, but I thought I understood your argument to be if a person were taking, say, a prescription drug of some kind and were prosecuted under 946.63, the standard...
346.63?
Yeah,
1A. Yeah.
That the standard would be higher than if the person were prosecuted under 940.25.1A.
I am not saying that. I am not saying that, but I can understand why you thought I was saying that. And that's why this is a can of worms that I...
Because,
on its face, 346.63 seems to treat the two differently.
Looks different because it says to a degree.
You know what?
I
have not reviewed the instruction. I'm sorry, Justice Ziegler is ahead of me here. She's reviewed the instructions under 346.63. I think you referred to 2666 or something, I guess, or something. I don't know. I just don't. You got us into something that really has no impact or effect on this case, and I just can't deal with it without going back and reviewing those instructions and seeing if it's treated differently. The statute appears to treat them differently. The statute does not attach the words renders him incapable of safely driving to using the intoxicant, using the controlled substance, or using the combination. It only attaches it to using it to the use of a drug, or a combination of a drug and an intoxicant. Now, whether that, how that is carried through in the instructions and plays out, I don't know. But I know that. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
2664 uses the word the phrase "less able to exercise clear judgment and steady hand."
Okay, and what is 24 dealing with?
2664 deals with 346.63.1A.
Yeah. Controlled substance. Well, what kind of substance?
Controlled substance.
Okay, well, and see, controlled substance, that would be okay, but now go to 2666, which Justice Ziegler was reading from, and there apparently, and she's lost it, it does put that incapable of safely driving language in.
There's a distinction between a drug case and an alcohol case.
No.
And the
which would be consistent with the statutory language, but...
we're not under either one of them.
But you're not, yeah.
This is a 940.
Don't get sidetracked
case.
Into that because, like I say, you're just opening up a can of worms that doesn't have to be dealt with.
Just stay focused, right?
Stay focused, yes. It's obviously on unless members of the court want to address other questions to me. I'm ready to.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Becker. Thank you very much, Mr. Zaleski. You would think with all of the driving cases under the influence, whether it be 346 or 940, we would have settled out this issue, which still seems to be unsettled. So we appreciate your arguments this morning. 06 AP 2753 CR state the Hubbard, the hearing is now finished. The court will adjourn for lunch and be back at 1:30. The students and everyone else who wishes to should remain, and Justice Crooks will be out momentarily to talk with you. We are in recess.